Well, y'all doing all right today? Okay, all right. Good to see everybody on Labor Day weekend here. Happy Labor Day and all that. I hope you guys do some fun stuff today with your family and friends. But I'm Carter. I'm one of the pastors here at Redemption Church, and I'm glad that you're with us, whether you're joining us here in person or whether you're joining us online. Thank you for being with us today and worshiping God. And you guys know we're in the middle of a series called Grow, The Secret to Spiritual Maturity. And the first week we talked about what that secret was right up front, right? We didn't want to hold anything back. The secret is to first grow deeper into the gospel. So if you want to mature in your faith, which means you want to grow more and more into the image of Christ, you want to grow content in your relationship with God and all of these different things, then you have to grow deeper into the gospel first. You have to understand the message that Jesus has done everything necessary to save you and make you right with God, and there's nothing you can do about it. He's done it all for you, right? And that's actually a hard concept for most of us to grasp. If we think about what it looks like to live as a human, we're so work-oriented, and we often lose sight of the love that God has for us, that we think our motivation for doing things for God ought to be out of a sense of guilt or shame or obligation, right? See, we have to realize first that God loves us, and that He set us free from guilt and shame and obligation. He's done it all on our behalf. It's not about what we can do for Him. It's about what He's done for us. That's the whole deal. That's the secret. And once we get that secret, we grow deeper into that gospel, then we can talk about some practices that we ought to follow to grow and mature in our faith. So we got to have the right motivation there. So last week, we talked about gathering, right? If we want to grow in spiritual maturity, we have to learn to gather with other believers in an intentional way. So we want to meditate on the gospel, but we can do that all day long. If we don't have other believers to be around and live that out with, then all that knowledge we have about Jesus and what He's done for us kind of is rendered useless. Because it's got to be worked out and lived out in a community of believers. We're actually going to talk more about that today as we talk about groups. Because remember, these are the five practices we've laid out that fuel spiritual growth. Gospel, gather, groups, give, and go. Right? Those are the five practices. So we're going to nail down on groups today. We're going to be in Acts chapter 2, verses 42 through 47. Again, that's our base camp text. And then we're actually going to go over to John chapter 13 today, verses 34 and 35 as well, if you want to put your finger on that. We're going to see these organic kinds of interactions. Last week was the formal, right? The early church met in formal worship gatherings. That turned to this weekly rhythm of meeting every Sunday throughout church history and had a little bit more structure, and they worshiped God and had specific things they did when they met together. They listened to the word preached. They took communion with one another, all these different things that they were done. But then they also met in homes throughout the week. And they shared everything that they had with everybody, and they gave to those in need. And, you know, in other words, they really did life with one another. That's kind of how we say it. You know, maybe that's the millennial way to say it. I heard Gen Zers are starting to make fun of that, so I'm not sure if that's true or not. But doing life together, it's actually just living with other people, living around them, being in one another's lives, kind of like a family, right? That's the whole idea, is that we're God's family now. And so for us, our main point for today, if you're taking notes and you want to write this down, is that groups get us into deeper community, okay? Groups get us into deeper community, and there's no deeper community than a family. That's the image that we have here coming out of Acts chapter 2. If the early church grouped together in homes throughout the week to practice being God's family, then we ought to practice that same thing and group together to be God's family together. And for us, that's primarily through DNA groups and community groups here. You know, gatherings are a needed part of what we do, but then we got to go deeper in groups so that we can be a family with one another. Groups do that. They take us deeper. I don't think I have to convince any of you guys that you want to spiritually mature. You know, if you notice, I haven't really tried to convince any of you over the last 2 weeks that you want that, because I was just assuming that you want that since you're here every Sunday, right? Everybody, if you're here, generally speaking, you want to grow closer to God. But part of growing closer to God means growing closer to each other. That's part of the whole deal. You can't have one without the other. And so what happens is we often religify the idea of spiritual maturity. We're like, well, you know, being spiritually mature means you start to look a certain way. You start to follow the rules. You start to look more like Jesus, which means you do the right things or you don't do the wrong things. But really, that's not it at all. We're so task-oriented in that we think it's that, but it's not. It's not rule-oriented. It's people-oriented. That's what Christian maturity actually looks like. We have to love others more authentically. We have to understand that Jesus loved us and love God more authentically. There's love involved here. It's not just tasks. There's love. And so Christian maturity is really about love more than it is about law, if we could say it like that, you know? That's what it looks like to mature. So we're so blinded by the task-oriented part and the church-oriented part, the religious-oriented part, we forget about the love. But that's the whole deal. It's all about love. Therefore, Christian maturity has to play itself out in a community, because you can't love people you're not around, right? Discipleship happens in community. We say that all the time here. And discipleship is just another way of talking about Christian maturity. You're learning to follow Jesus more and more closely and look more and more like him. And so it can't happen unless you're around other believers. And you know, many of us seem to treat church like a club. We talk about that a lot here as well. And clubs have members, right? You opt into being a club, though. You pay dues. You show up to functions every so often. You become a member because you want to gather with other people who have the same hobby or interest or whatever it might be for your status or whatever it is. And your membership's based on those mutual interests. It's kind of, we might say membership in a club is based on sameness, you know? That's kind of what it looks like to be in a club. I'm not saying that's bad. That's just how clubs operate. See, families operate in a different way. Families have members, but you can't just opt in to being a family, right? Now, some of y'all might know that more acutely than other people, you know, depending on who your family is and how it is, right? Some of you guys might understand you're stuck with your family. You can't get away from, if they're your biological family, you're just a part of a family. Everybody comes from a family. Even if it's a broken family, we still know that families, you can't get away from. Hopefully you have a good family, maybe you don't, but it's family. And that's all that it is. And everybody's got that crazy uncle or that crazy cousin or whatever in their family that they know about that it's like, yeah, we know. That's just crazy so-and-so, right? You know, maybe you have a conspiracy theory cousin that's all I want to talk about when you get together. I promise you, I have that in my family. Or maybe you got that out-of-control uncle that's always, you know, like giving everybody noogies and doing crazy, weird stuff, you know, and yelling all the time and all that. I'm getting ready to go to my annual family reunion right after this. I'm actually going to leave before the service is over. I'm sorry. I know gathering is very important, but so is gathering with your family once a year. We do it once a year every Labor Day. It's 1 o'clock, but it's about an hour and a half away, so we got to drive to get there. And I've got some crazy family members, okay? I'm from the country. If you know my mom, it's her family that we're from the country. And so I understand what it looks like to have some crazy uncles and cousins and all that. There's this one crazy family member that everybody knows she's crazy. She's nuts, okay? And the main reason that she's crazy is because she moons people just randomly, okay? Now, maybe you're not from that kind of culture, but this is a country culture, okay? So you got to keep that in mind. I mean, you're just minding your own business, standing there talking to people, and then all of a sudden, bam, you turn around, there's a bare rear end in your face, you know? It's just like, golly, put that thing away. Nobody wants to see that, you know? Everybody knows she's crazy. She's the crazy cousin, yet she's family, you know? And so we just roll our eyes and say, okay, that's crazy so-and-so, whatever, you know? Just ignore her, you know? I mean, a family can't not be a family, even if you got the crazy ones in there. And no matter the differences, no matter the sameness, doesn't matter. It's not based on sameness. It's not based on opting in. You can't do any of that. There's something deeper there, right? That's what makes up a family. You're just family. And that's what groups will get us toward as a church. That's what groups are getting. They're getting us into that deeper kind of community with one another. So let's read Acts chapter 2 again, starting in verse 42. We'll get our grounding there, and then we'll talk about it for a second and jump over to John chapter 13 after that. All right, here we go. Acts chapter 2, verse 42. It says, they devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching, to the fellowship, to the breaking of bread, which you talked about as communion, and to prayer. Everyone was filled with awe, and many wonders and signs were being performed through the apostles. Now all the believers were together and held all things in common. They sold their possessions and property and distributed the proceeds to all as any had need. Every day they devoted themselves to meeting together in the temple and broke bread from house to house. And they ate their food with joyful and sincere hearts, praising God and enjoying the favor of all the people in the city. And then every day the Lord added to their number those who were being saved. Now that's what we've talked about for the last 3 weeks now. Remember, this is how Christians in the early church looked after they got saved. After they became the church, this is what they looked like. So we've summed it up in the five practices, right? They got together around the gospel, gathered, groups, give, and go. That's what they did. Those were their practices. And we see them devoting themselves to the teaching of the apostles, the gospel. We see them gathering at the temple to worship in a more formal way, like we talked about last week. We see them grouping together house to house throughout the week and doing life with one another. We see them giving to those in need, and then we see them going to those so that God can add to their number day by day. And if we just nail down on groups today, what we're going to see them doing here has an expression in the larger gathering. Of course, they're going to get together, they're going to fellowship, they're going to devote themselves to the apostles' teaching and all of that. But there's also this deeper community that they have around those things as well. Now, I'd encourage you to go back and listen to last week if you weren't here. But this week, we'll see that the early believers spoke the gospel to one another when they were doing life together, right? They broke bread together, which might mean they practiced communion or at least a form of communion. We're not sure. It doesn't really matter. They're doing life together in that way. And they worshiped in homes throughout the week. And they gave and they shared and all of these things. The overall tone of this is that doing life with one another kind of concept, which really just means that they were around each other often. They were in each other's lives in some way. They weren't just disjointed. They just didn't just go up and show up anonymously on a Sunday and then leave and go and do things throughout the week by themselves. They were with one another. They were a family with one another. They weren't a club. They were a family. You could say it like this as well. The church isn't an aggregation. It's a congregation. It's another way of thinking about this. It's not an aggregation. I heard one pastor say it like this. I thought it was brilliant. It's Tim Keller, if you need to know, okay, because he's brilliant. You know, he's the greatest. But he was talking about how many of us think of it like an aggregation. You know, if you think of an aggregation, it's just a collection of things. So if you think about church like a bag of marbles, then you're thinking about it wrongly, because marbles are, you know, they're aggregated. They're just a bunch of disjointed things, balls, marbles, that are in a bag. So they occupy the same space, but they're not connected in any real way. They're just occupying the same space together. See, a congregation's different than that. A congregation's much more like a cluster of grapes. Grapes, you can't get away from. As soon as you pull a grape off of the vine, then it's not a part of the cluster anymore, and it's going to die. It's going to shrivel up and die. That's what a church looks like. That's what a congregation looks like. They have the same life source. They're connected to the same vine, and if you pull them off the vine, then they're going to shrivel up and die because they cannot be alone. They can't be any more apart from the vine than they can be apart from one another. That's what it looks like to be in a church. That's supposed to be us. Once we follow Jesus, we're inseparable from one another, from others who follow Jesus, no matter where we are, right? We think of that in our context in Roanoke, Virginia, and we all kind of have a similar type of lifestyle in America. Maybe not quite, right? We come from different cultural backgrounds and stuff, but we have the same things in common with believers over in Morocco today, over in Africa today, over in China today. We hold all things in common that matter because we're connected to the same vine. We're a cluster of grapes, man. That's what it looks like for us. You can't get away from those people that are in your life that follow Jesus. Jesus talks about this in John 15, right? He says, he's the vine and we're the branches. So we can't separate ourselves from him. We can't separate ourselves from one another. It's just how it works. And we've already talked about how Sunday gatherings help get us there, but groups just get us even deeper into that kind of community throughout the week. So you can write this down as well. For our church, our community groups and DNA groups ensure we're getting into deeper community. That's how we ensure that that's happening here. That's our structure for this. It's more of an organic kind of community, but it still has a light structure underneath of it to be healthy, you know? But see, the structure is not the point. We don't just structure and gather these things because, again, we don't want to just gather a crowd. And we're not just trying to make our numbers go up and all this kind of stuff. Although that can be an indicator of health. What we're trying to do is just create those organic relationships, give it a place. Give them a structure on which to lean against, kind of like a tomato plant, okay? If you plant a tomato, I'm not a green thumb, so I don't know. Tammy's the one that does that in our life. You know, my wife, she's the one that grows things, so she knows this better than me. But if you plant a tomato plant and you give it a stake, it will grow against that stake so that it will not fall over. Because if you don't put like a stake or maybe a trellis, you know, you've seen those circular metal trellises that you can stick over the plant as it grows. That's what people use often now. So if you do it without a trellis, it'll still grow, but eventually it'll just plop over onto the ground. And of course, that opens it up to things like disease, you know, and rot, insects that are going to eat at it, because it doesn't have a way to protect itself. It doesn't have any, it's on the ground. And so it's not going to survive very long. But if you put that trellis around it, and it leans up against the trellis as it grows organically, man, it's going to be all that it can be. It's going to produce all that it can produce, right? That trellis just gives it the just a little bit of structure it needs to lean up against so that as it grows, it can grow in a healthy way. And that, for us, is what it looks like to have a structure. You could even write this down as well if you want to. The structure isn't the end goal. The relationships are. See, it's not about the structure. It's not about the groups. Listen, I promise you, if they stop working, then we'll change them to something else. Right? We don't need the groups. The groups just help us get us into deeper community. So while that works right now in our cultural context, that's what we're going to do, but they're not the point. The relationships are. So let me just give you our trellis very quickly here as to what we do in our groups.
Our community groups are 10 to 15 people or so. I know one other group's like, no, it's more than that, you know. It's okay. Somewhere in that general range. Doesn't really matter, but somewhere in that general range that meets in somebody's home on a weekly basis and talks about the Bible and has fellowship with one another. That's what our community groups are. It's pretty basic, right? There's really, I mean, there may be a couple other things you want to do. We want to serve together. We want to do a couple of other things, and that's it. It's meant to foster that deeper kind of community and to have intentional conversations that are gospel-centered and to be able to pray for one another and be in one another's lives. And if something comes up, you go to that person, you help that person as a group and all of that. It's a very basic structure. Our DNA groups are similar, but they even have a looser structure than that. They're 2 to 4 people, same gender, similar life stage if we can help it, because we're still a little small right now. But as we grow, that'll just get traction more and more. And they meet every other week. And they discuss accountability issues in those groups, what's going on, what sins you're struggling with, what celebrations you have. And then they pray for one another. And that's it. That's all that DNA groups are meant to be. They're just to intentionally prompt you to do what you ought to be doing as a Christian anyway. Right? But they give you a little bit of structure so that as you grow and mature, you can do that in a healthy way. But in saying all of that, here's the kicker for it, okay? Here's the secret sauce for this particular topic, the groups topic. See, we're going to provide the structure as a church, but you have to want the community. Right? We can hold your hand here, man. We're holding your hand in these ways. But if you don't get involved in it and you don't take advantage of it, then it's not going to help you at all. We can provide a trellis all day long, but if you're not leaning up against it, you're not going to mature and grow in a healthy way. You've got to devote yourself like it says in Acts chapter 2. They weren't just devoted to the apostles' teaching, although they were, but that's kind of a stanza for the whole rest of the paragraph. They're devoted to the fellowship. They're devoted to being with one another and gathering. They're devoted to being in homes. They're devoted to giving. They're devoted to going. They devoted themselves to this kind of lifestyle. That's what it looks like to follow Jesus. So you have to ask yourself a couple of questions here. Is this the structure that you want to lean up against so that you can grow here at our church, you know, Redemption Church, the way that we do things? And do you even want to grow at all? I think those are the two big questions that you might have right now for this. Do you even want to grow at all? Because listen, if you don't want to be in deeper community with other believers, I totally understand. I'm an introvert. It's hard to be around other people. But if you don't have that desire at all, then you don't want to grow and mature in your faith. Because you got to be around other believers to do that. It's easy to come on a Sunday morning and be anonymous. But it's a whole other thing when you got to get around other people in their home and they start asking you questions about what you do and what you're all about and what you love and what you hate and all these different things. It gets real when you start rubbing up against other people, right? Get up close and personal. So here's what I'm going to do with the rest of our time. I want to show you what kind of this kind of close community looks like, okay? And we're just going to do it based off of what Jesus taught his disciples. You know, if you go turn to the Gospel of John chapter 13, it starts his discourse on the disciples and their love for one another. He emphasizes this multiple times. But this is the beginning of how he does that for them. John chapter 13, verse 34, he says, "I give you a new command, love one another. Just as I have loved you, you're also to love one another. By this, everyone will know that you're my disciples." Very interesting. Jesus says this new community that he's building, the church, it's based on love for one another. That's how he describes this community. That's the nature of it. It's the character of it. Now, it's an odd little way that he says this. He's like, this is a new commandment, right? So what's he mean by that? Because obviously it's not a new commandment. You know, I mean, elsewhere we've read him say to a religious leader, hey, the greatest commandment is to love God and love others as yourself. So he's already referenced this, and he was referencing Leviticus 19, which is the commandment that was given to Israel. It says this, "Do not take revenge or bear a grudge against members of your community, but love your neighbor as yourself." So why does he say it's new? It's not new, obviously. Well, it's because he does put a twist on it. He puts the Jesus twist on it, okay? He says, love one another just as I have loved you. He doesn't say love one another as you love yourself. The new commandment is to love one another as I have loved you. You can write this down. Love others as Jesus has loved you. That's the new commandment. It's one thing to be motivated to love others as yourself and to have it self-serving and be self-interested in that, right? Love others, treat others the way that you want to be treated, right? We say that all the time. It's the golden rule. But it's a wholly different thing to have a different motivation that's based off of what Jesus has done on your behalf. It's a new motivation, right? That's what he's saying here. He's suggesting something completely different. You love other people because I've loved you. Not because you love yourself, although you do, but do it because I've loved you in the gospel. It's the secret. It's the secret that we always have to go back to in each one of these G's, each one of these practices, right? It's what he's done for us. That's how we grow in our faith. We have to know the gospel before we can ever hope to start to love other people. Love them because Jesus loved you first. And if you're struggling to want to be in Christian community, maybe it's because you need to remember that the love that God has shown for you first in the gospel. Maybe you're struggling with that. I don't know. Maybe that's why it's hard for you to be around other believers, because you're still struggling to know that God loves you. God has loved us with such sacrificial love that he laid his life down for us. John 15, Jesus said to his disciples, "This is my command, love one another as I have loved you." He says it over and over and over again throughout all these chapters in John. And then he says, "No one has greater love than this, to lay down his life for his friends." That's what it looks like to love. Jesus laid his life down to make us his friends. Man, we really need to understand the depth of what that looks like, how special and incredible and miraculous that really is for the eternal God to come down and make these broken creatures part of his family. So let's just look at some of the things that Jesus did to show his disciples love here so we can understand and then try to apply it to our own lives if we can. But the first thing is that Jesus served his disciples. That's how he showed them love, by serving them, right? Just if we go back a little ways in John chapter 13, Jesus washed his disciples' feet before they began the Passover meal to symbolize what he was about to do for them on the cross. Now, maybe we don't fully understand the significance of foot washing because we don't practice that in our culture. I mean, maybe we can kind of understand, because if you're like me, I think the idea of touching somebody else's nasty feet is just gross, you know? I just don't want to do that. That just kind of grosses me out. So Jesus does it, though. In that day, you think about why they washed feet. Was because they walked everywhere that they went. And most of the time they had open-toed shoes or sandals on, usually when they were walking. And so you can think about them walking in the dirt, walking in the mud, probably walking through animal poop, you know? I mean, their feet are disgusting for all of the reasons that ours are, but then more, okay? I mean, it's gross. And so when you would go into somebody's home, you would either wash your own feet, they'd provide a way for you to do that, or they would have one of their servants, the lowest of the low, the person that's the lowest position in their household, do it, because it's not an honorable thing. You know, that's not, you wouldn't have the leader. The king doesn't wash people's feet. Other people wash his feet. They kiss his ring, all of these different things. But Jesus, he comes in and he says, no, before we begin this last meal that we're going to have with one another, and before I go to do the thing that I've come here to do, to love you more than you could ever imagine, I'm going to show you by washing your feet. I'm going to take off my nice garments and I'm going to put an apron on. I'm going to get on my hands and knees. And that's what he does. And they're indignant about it, right? If you go back and read the story in the beginning of the chapter, Peter protests and he says, "Lord, you'll never wash my feet." He's thinking, I'm the one that needs to be washing your feet. You're my authority. I need to be serving you. And Jesus is saying, no. He says, if I don't wash you, you have no part with me. And he's alluding to how he would ultimately lay down his life for them to wash them clean of sin, right? Saying, if I don't wash you clean of sin, then you're never going to be able to be with me. If I don't serve you on the cross, if I don't die for your sins and wash your sin-blackened soul, then you're not going to be able to be with me forever and be in community with me and be in my family. They didn't understand that yet, but Jesus was trying to tell them. Because see, they had the wrong idea of authority. They had the wrong idea of what it looks like to relate to others. They thought an authority, just like we do, that when you have the power, you should use it for self-promotion and self-benefit, right? Are you smart? Well, then leverage that to make money. Do you have money? Then leverage that to increase your standard of living. Do you have a position of power? Well, then leverage that to control the world in a way that benefits you or your family. That's what you do with power, right? That's what you do with authority. But see, Jesus has all those things and he flips them upside down. He says that he's the richest, he's the most powerful, he's the one with all of this stuff, and yet he lays it all down for us, right? I mean, Jesus, he was all wise. I mean, he had all the riches of heaven. He had all the power of the Creator God, and yet he laid all of that down. He used his power not to protect himself from danger, but to pour himself out because his disciples were in danger of eternal damnation. That's what Jesus did. He did it for their benefit, not for his. So for us, if we apply this to ourselves, let's ask the question, are we leveraging what we have to serve each other? Are we doing that same thing? Does this mark the love that we have for our community of believers, or for any believers for that matter? Does this characterize our community? If we just start with our big gatherings, low bar here, right? Did you take seriously the call last week to attend and serve? You know? Or were you thinking of all the excuses as to why you can't do that? I mean, we give you guys the easiest possible on-ramp and a way to serve other believers. And I'm not sure if this happens at our church or not. It probably does. But, you know, I remember hearing this from people in Greensboro when we helped plant Mercy Hill. I heard the conversations. They would come to me directly and say these things like, well, you know, I'm with my own kids all week. I don't want to serve in kids ministry. Why would I want to do that? Or they'd say things like, oh, I'm really overwhelmed at work. I can't just come an hour early to serve. I'm very overwhelmed. I can't do one more thing in my life. So I can't serve on a Sunday. You may not hear people say stuff like that. Maybe that's your excuse too. Maybe you have an excuse like that. I don't know. But I want to lovingly and directly just ask you, are you leveraging what you have for others serving? Or are you leveraging what you have for self-serving? I think that's an important question to ask. And so let's not limit it to just Sundays. That's just the low bar. Remember, that's the floor, not the ceiling. So let's just ask the question of our entire life. Do you have a general attitude of serving others, especially other believers? Or is it a general attitude of divisiveness? You know, we see this a lot in our city. And I know it's in cities all over the United States, but other Christians, they probably don't like that we're here. They don't like that we planted a church. We're competition to them. Is it an attitude of service or self-serving? We need to make sure that we evaluate our hearts in that. Are we divisive? Are we in competition with other believers? No. Do we have a general attitude of serving others? Or, you know, if we just apply this to other things in our life, when you do your job, do you see that as service to others? Or do you see it as something self-serving? You know, like you do it for money, or you do it for influence, or you do it for the approval of others. Or when you go to a community group, do you primarily go so that people can pour into you or so that you can pour out to others? Is it self-serving or is it others-serving? Or when you have to make big decisions in your life, do you make them based off of how that can best serve the community of believers, or do you do it based off of how the community of believers can best serve you? You know, it's the JFK, or yeah, the JFK quote, right? It's not what you can do for your country, it's what your country can do for you. Wait, no, it's the opposite, isn't it? Right? It's not what you can do. It's not what your country can do. What can you do for your country? What can you do for the body? That's how we have to live our lives, with that kind of attitude of service. Caitlin, our kids coordinator, shared with me this week that right after Adam and Laura moved here from Wilmington to help us plant the church and to lead worship, they just would invite her over for dinner so every so often, just to serve her and get to know her and to love her. And she said that just impacted her life in a very special way. Just something so small, just to invite people into your life, just to have someone over, just so that you can get to know them and pour into them and love them. Dakota told me something very similar this week with his growth. He said he'd never experienced such growth as when Christian, mature Christian godly men in his life invited him into their lives, just to be around them when they were doing stuff around the house or folding laundry or whatever it is, you know, it doesn't matter. Just being around people, that means so much to serve others by inviting them in. Are you leveraging your life to serve others? Let me ask it this way. This one will get you because it got me this week. What if Jesus leveraged his life for you the same way you've been leveraging your life for others? What would be the state of your heart and situation? Would he have still gone to the cross for you? Or would he have just had a lot of nice words that were empty and really didn't have any substance behind them? 1 John 3 says, this is how we have to come to know love. He laid down his life for us. We should also lay down our lives for our brothers and sisters. If anyone has this world's goods and sees a fellow believer in need but withholds compassion from him, how does God's love reside in him? Little children, let us not love in word or in speech, but in action and in truth. Man, our love has to be more than words. That's convicting to me as much as it might be to you. But see, the easiest place to start that is living in community with others in groups here in our church, DNA group, community group. That's the easiest place. We're holding your hand in that. We're giving you the opportunity. Groups get us deeper in community. They aren't the only way, right? And it's not about the structure, but they get us there if we'll lean into them and lean on them as we grow. But a second way that Jesus loved his disciples was that he shared his life with them. Jesus shared his life with his disciples. See, God didn't stay up in heaven, right? So just hoping we would find our way back to him. He came to us. He came in to share life with us. He incarnated himself to become a human being and live just like you and I live every day. He was born into pain and poverty, into betrayal and into love. And he came so near to us and so close to us that he could be touched and interrupted and hurt and hugged. There's a story earlier in John's gospel in chapter 11 where Jesus was on his way to see his sick friend Lazarus. You might remember this story. And, you know, he gets there just in time to realize that Lazarus had already died a few days before that. He's late. And when he shows up, all of Lazarus' family is crying and weeping and mourning. And so we have the shortest verse in all the Bible, right? 11:35. Let's just say Jesus wept, right? You look at that story and you're like, why would he have wept? He knew he was literally going to raise him from the dead. Why? Why would he weep then? Why wouldn't he be like, guys, don't cry. This is exciting. This is going to be great. No, he stopped and he slowed down and he wept with Lazarus' family. And it's because he felt their pain. He shared life with them. He connected with them in their brokenness. See, he didn't just come to give us new life, although that's his ultimate goal, right? But he came to experience the brokenness of this life with us, to live the way that we'd lived, and then to overcome all of that brokenness on our behalf. He was so connected to humanity that he wept. He does that with us too. He knows what you're going through today. Maybe you're going through something hard. He's opened himself up to you. He's feeling what you've felt and what you're feeling right now. Do you have a broken heart over someone or something today? Man, Jesus is with you in that. He feels that with you. Are you struggling with something or someone in your life today? Jesus feels that with you. He's not a distant God. He shares his life with us. And so for us, let's ask the question as we try to apply it to our own lives. Are we sharing ourselves with one another in our community? Are you putting on a mask every week that you come in here or that you go to group? Or are you on the team enough to be completely open with who you are? That's hard. It's very hard to do that. But we've seen so many breakthroughs in people's lives and overcoming sin and all these things, moving them from a place of bondage to freedom and all of these things, but only when they're willing to open themselves up and share all of themselves and put it all on the table, who they are. You know, warts and all, right? That's what DNA groups are for. That's what they do at our church. I can't tell you how many guys have gone through our DNA groups, and while they're not completely free from sin, nobody is going to be. I mean, they've seen some tremendous victories in overcoming things like an addiction to pornography or like overcoming anger in their lives or anxiety in their lives by just opening themselves up to other believers who can pour into them and help them understand the gospel and how it applies to their situation and their sin. See, that's what sin tries to do. It tries to isolate you and I. Sin isolates us. You can write that down if you're taking notes. Sin kills community. That's what sin does. The Bible says the wages of sin is death, and of course that's true, but it starts by being alone and being feeling forsaken here in this life. I heard, again, Tim Keller say it like that. Yeah, the wages of sin is death, of course, because eternal death is separation and forsakenness from God. Then of course it's going to start in this life. We're going to feel that way. We're going to feel so alone. Sin does that. It isolates. It isolates us from one another. It isolates us from God. But that's the beauty of the gospel, is that Jesus came in to overcome that isolation. He shared his life with us so that we would have community with him. He was forsaken and isolated for us, from God, from his community, so that we could be brought into his family with him. That's the beauty of what he's done. We don't have to be alone. And we're made for this kind of community. Spence Shelton, a pastor out of Charlotte, North Carolina, said it like this one time. We were created by a community in the image of a community to live in community. And we're created in a family. We can't get away from community. That's how it has to happen. We have to be around other people. We're created by a community in the image of the community of God's Trinitarian nature, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, a community within himself. We're created to live in community with one another. You know, that's what it looks like to be a human being. So are you willing to take off the mask and open yourself up to this kind of deep community and to have group with one another in a meaningful, authentic way, right? That's our core value, authentic community. What excuses are you using right now for not doing that in your group? Or let me just ask you this, what excuses are you using right now for not being in a group at all? If you're not in a group yet, you need to get in one, because groups get us into deeper community. But then here's the last point I want to make with Jesus' love for his disciples. Jesus bridged the gap between us and God. He bridged that gap. And I think there's something in all of us that wants to be around people that are just like us, right? And that's okay. You know, it's normal to want that. People of the same education level, people in the same socioeconomic status, people from the same ethnicity, people from the same culture, whatever it is, we have things in common with people. We want to gravitate toward those people, and that's fine. But if you begin to think about what Jesus has done for us, there was no greater gap than the one that was between us and God. I mean, he was the creator of the universe. He designed the nucleus of the atom, and he created the fabric of space-time and holds it all together right now. I mean, you and I can't even figure out how to change our email signature most of the time, you know? I mean, it's like, who are we, you know? And God's wisdom is far beyond ours. I mean, he was rich, the richest of rich, right? He owns all of the things in the universe. He's the king over heaven and earth. You and I are the dust of the earth. He's so far beyond us. He was perfectly holy. He is perfect within himself. He created all things to be perfect, and we broke it in our brokenness. We're so sinful, we can't even live up to our own standards that we create for ourselves, much less God's perfect standard of holiness. That gap was infinite between us and God, and yet Jesus came to bridge that gap with his life in our place, his perfect life in our place, and his sacrificial death in our place. And then he rose from the dead to overcome death so that one day we can overcome death with him. And that's the amazing thing about what he's done, man. Jesus didn't come because he was lonely. He came because he knew we were lonely and isolated and forsaken. And he didn't want us to be. He wanted to bring us into his family. See what great love the Father has given us that we should be called God's children, and so we are. Man, we're God's children because Jesus bridged the gap and brought us in and brought us near. My question for us today as we apply this now to ourselves is, are we bridging the gap for others? Is that how we're living our Christian lives? Are we bridging the gap for others? Does that characterize your Christianity and your faith and maturity? Are you building a life around people you feel comfortable with or around people who need Jesus, no matter how comfortable they make you feel? Are you building your life for your own security or the security of your family and your future, or be dangerous for the sake of the mission and to make yourself uncomfortable for the sake of loving God's family? Man, to follow Jesus is to follow him across that gap. And I'm not even talking about reaching the lost yet. We haven't even gotten to go yet, have we? Man, we're going to get there in 2 weeks. I'm talking about loving each other, loving other believers, loving believers across the world. I'm asking, are you willing to serve and love other believers even when they're not like you? Are you willing to show partiality in your life? Is that what you're going to do? Or are you going to show passion and love for one another? It's a hard thing, but church folk need Jesus too, right? Church folk need grace too. I need you to bridge the gap for me. I want to try to bridge the gap for you. That's what it looks like to be in a family with one another, in community group. If somebody shares a personal problem they're dealing with in their life, do you try to give them a 10-step plan to fix it? Just like a religiosity type of, well, just do these things and you'll be okay? Or do you try to remind them what Jesus has done on their behalf? And that they're not identified by the brokenness that they have in their life. When you're in DNA group, when somebody finally gets up enough courage to share that sin habit that they've been struggling with and they don't want to tell anybody and they're ashamed of, does your response reflect the grace that you've been shown in the gospel? Or does it reinforce their fear that they shouldn't have shared it with anybody and that they're never going to be able to change? We've got to be able to bridge the gap, guys. We want to be a church that bridges that gap. We want to be characterized by openness and authenticity and sharing our lives with one another and serving one another in these ways, not looking to our own interests, but to the interests of others is more important than ourselves. We want to bridge the gap and share grace and the gospel and be gospel-centered. And this is ultimately how we want our groups to function. You know, they're the laboratory for our knowledge of the gospel. They're where we actually live it out every day with one another. And guess what? If you devote yourself to that, it's going to change you. I promise it will, and it'll mature you. So you can write this down as well. If you want to grow in your spiritual maturity, then devote yourself to Christian community. That's how you grow here. You know, it's one of the five G's for a reason. You got to be around other believers. Because who you're around will dictate who you become. This is how Craig Rochelle, pastor out of Oklahoma, says it. Show me your friends, and I'll show you your future. My concern for us as modern Christians in the United States of America is that we are so independent, we don't know how to practice authentic community, and we're just too afraid to try. Now, I have a good analogy for this. I've delved into the world of Navy SEALs over the years, and some of you guys are already rolling your eyes. I'm family, just bear with me, okay? You know I'm a Navy SEAL wannabe, okay? I'll say it, I wanna be that, and I also know that I never can be. I'm not so crazy to think that I could be as awesome as some of those SEALs are, man, I'm telling you. But I'm fascinated with it. And I'm fascinated with the idea that these elite warriors and these teams who are the best of the best of the best, how they do what they do. How do they become the best? How did they make it in? You know, you ask the question, who becomes a Navy SEAL? And you think, well, is it the big burly guys who are tough and can bench press 300 pounds? Is it the elite athletes who can swim or run for miles without stopping? Is it the guys who have the mental fortitude to just push on, push through, no matter what adversity they face? Maybe. Maybe. It's more complex than you might think, though, because when you read any of these guys, any of these SEALs, any of these people that will tell you, how do you get onto a Navy SEALs team? Who is it that makes it onto that? Maybe it's some of those guys who are big and bad and gritty. Maybe. But it's always the guys who know the value of the team and taking care of the person on the left and on the right. Those are the guys who make it. They can be skinny and scrawny. Doesn't matter. If they understand the value of the team, then they will go on to make it. That's how it happens for them. So for us, if we're ever going to make it into spiritual maturity, if we ever hope to live with purpose and be satisfied in Christ and go from restless to redemption and look more like Jesus in our everyday lives, then we got to know that the team comes first in some sense. We got to know the immense value of the team, because God has set it up for us to, yes, know him vertically, but then to know each other horizontally, and you can't have the one without the other. That's just how it works. That's how he's set it up. So my encouragement for you today is, if you want to call this church your home and you want to go deeper in community, you want to mature in your faith, then you got to sign up for a community or DNA group if you haven't done that yet. And then you actually got to go to the ones that you've signed up for if you haven't done that yet either, you know. You got to be around community. So listen, we got Matt, our ministry resident, out there in the hallway at a table. And he's going to be there taking with the computer, signing you up if you haven't signed up. So stop by the table out there before you leave today and be ready for God to change you through community. But don't just take my word for it. We got a video this week that I want to show you, just a story of some of our members and how community has radically changed their life here at Redemption Church. Why don't you watch this with me, and then we'll respond.